Blog Talk Radio.
Carol the Coach. Sex, love, and relationships. We talk about it here.
Carol the Coach. Compassion with contemporary relevance.
I am a psychotherapist. I can be your personal life coach, and I can help you with your issues. There are no problems too small or too big. You can talk about anything.
Speaker, columnist, radio TV host, and commentator. Carol the Coach brings messages of wellness and empowerment within reach of everyday people every day.
Almost 5 years ago, I lost my soulmate in an accident. He was killed in a plane crash. Life just for me has seemed to stop.
There are groups all over the city. I mean, I teach one. It is a specific way to start thinking so that you shift how you see the world, which then shifts your energy, and then you feel better and you actually see things differently.
Carol the Coach. Always available to at carolthecoach.com.
Now, I've got Russell on the line.
I'm 47 years old. I'm a truck driver. I'm married. I have a wife in San Francisco.
Okay.
I haven't been home in 6 months. My thing is, I don't know if I have a sex addiction or what the problem is. Why do I want what I can't have? And as soon as I can have it, I don't want it anymore.
You're right on target when you say, I don't know if I have a sexual addiction. Well, guess what? Yes, you do. And you know what? That's my specialty, Russell. So you're at the right place. Continue.
I meet women online, and I'm in a different part of the country. I travel all 48 states, so I love sex.
I hear self-esteem issues. You never felt good enough, and you didn't feel like you were getting what you should have then, and you're reenacting that now. Do you want to change that about yourself?
Oh, yeah. That is the question. Do you want to change that about yourself? Come on, let's face it. For so long, your addiction has been your best friend. Okay, it hasn't been your best friend. It has been that thing that you could go to day or night. You could go to for 20 minutes, or you could go to for 6 hours. You know, it didn't talk back. It just was available to you. And sex addiction is a process addiction. It is by far the hardest addiction to face and to conquer. Now, when I say conquer, I don't mean that you can figure out a formula that makes sex addiction go away. What I truly mean is that it is an addiction that you can learn how to manage. Hi there, I'm Carol Jurgensen-Sheets, Carol the Coach, and I am here with you every Monday night at 9 o'clock to talk about what you can do to... And you know, sometimes I wonder, how the heck did I get into this field? I am a psychotherapist. I actually believed in working with people 6, 8, 10 sessions or less to help them straighten out their problems, set them on their way. They would practice what we worked on, and they would feel better. It was called brief strategic therapy. It was a good gig. I loved it. People got better, and they didn't have to be involved in therapy for years and years and years. And then, from there, it's no surprise that I went to coaching. I decided that I was going to learn what personal life coaching was all about. And for some of you that may not know my story, I had wanted to be on radio and television. And if you go to my website, Sex Help with Carol the Coach, or you go to caroltecoach.com, those are two separate websites. One's for people that want to improve not only their mental health, but they want to take their life to the next level. That's carolthecoach.com. If you go to sexhelpwithcarolthecoach.com, you get information about sexual addiction. Well, anyway, I had not studied sexual addiction yet, so I decided I wanted to do radio and television and possibly write a book. And I put together this demo tape at a high school, and I threw it together and submitted it to every radio station in town. I'm from Indianapolis, Indiana, and I had done DJing, so I kind of knew what I was doing. So I made this faux tape, and I didn't get any response. And I waited 6 months, and I sent it again, and this time by a sports station that said I had a good voice, and they wished me well. And I said, hey, I'll do sports hypnotherapy for you. And they said, no, we're not interested. At that point, I submitted my resume to the Indianapolis Star, which was a Gannett paper, and I got a column in that Indianapolis Star with 800,000 readers, and it was called Carol the Coach. They wanted a personal life coach, and I had just signed up for my first workshop on coaching. I really believed in that. I utilized it in my own therapy. So I knew what some of the coaching principles were, but I knew that I didn't know what a coach was. Well, they asked me to submit three different columns. One column was on the onion theory, which talked about the fact that men typically feel anger and then sadness. Women feel sadness and then anger. My second column was on body dysmorphia, how men and women really look at their bodies and look at it worse than it is and then feel low self-esteem. And then my third column was on what was a personal life coach. I had to get out, I had to get out 11 books in the library to make sure that I was going to be defining it appropriately. Well, believe it or not, I got the column. My workshop got canceled. I vowed to be certified. I went and did a two-year program out of Chicago through IPEC, an international professional empowerment coaching group, and I started doing coaching. But deep down inside, I was getting a lot of referrals from schools that did not know how to handle the hypersexuality of their students. Nobody knew what to do with it. And because I handled the sexual issues within the largest hospital setting in Indianapolis, I thought, I need to get more help. So I got trained as a certified sexual addictions therapist for the kids that I was working with. And of course, I'm sure I could devote my time to the kids. I am really partial to working with men and women who have sexual addiction. And in working with them, I became just as partial, if even not more so, towards the loved ones that have relationships with sex addicts, the partners of the sexual addicts, if you will. And so that's where I am right now. And I have just put together a YouTube channel under Sex Help with Carol the Coach, and I want you to go there, okay? I've only got about 12 videos right now, but I have promised to put 3 videos on a week. You'll see me and my dog, Boo. Boo always sits with me when I'm talking to the camera. And we give you hints on how to handle your sexual addiction, what recovery tools you need, how to handle the partners if you're a partner, how to decide can you trust your spouse. And I am 1 hour shy of getting my certification with APSETS, which is an organization that certifies people who are partner sensitive. So I feel like I've done it all and want to be available to you. I'm just so blessed to be with you. And you know me, I interview the experts all over the world on sexual addiction. We are the only sexual addiction show, radio show, through iTunes, exclusively on sexual addiction. And tonight, I'm going to be interviewing a listener who wants to share his hope, strength, recovery anonymously. He's a sex addict and a listener of the show, and there are things he's learned along the way regarding his faith recovery methodology and failures that he hopes will benefit others. Now, I'm a big believer in talking with people. You know I've had many addicts and partners on before. So he's going to be talking about how his addiction began and How did his family of origin contribute to the problems? He's not blaming them, but we all know that there's two ways to get sexual addiction. One is to have core issues you've never worked through in your life. And then the second way is just to have begun with developing a bad habit that turns into a compulsivity that turns into an addiction. Now, did anybody see the Anthony Weiner schedule? Anthony Weiner had more of his bad behaviors exposed today, and it is a story that, you know, absolutely points to what sexual addiction is all about. And allegedly, his wife has said, enough is enough. I'm no longer going to be humiliated and embarrassed publicly. And we all know that she works for Hillary Clinton, and she's really done her very best, it would appear, to deal with this situation. I suspect Anthony allegedly sent a risque photograph with his sleeping son beside him. And, you know, there are boundaries that people won't cross, and moms absolutely have to protect their kids. And this was probably the final straw. So we have a lot of compassion for him, but we also know that she has to do her absolute best to keep him protected. And so several of the addicts I talked with today said that they had looked up the scandal, and they did feel some compassion, but they also saw where, wow, it doesn't seem like he's working a strong recovery program. You know, with sexual addiction, the first course of action is to find a CSAT. That is a certified sexual addictions therapist in your area. So what you go to is sexhelp.com, and you put in your zip code, your state, or your country, and out will come therapists that work in your specific area. And if there is no therapist, no certified sexual addiction therapist that works in your town, in your city, in your country, well, then you can look for therapists at Zoom. I say Skype, but, you know, Skype is not HIPAA compliant. So we all have to change that about our the way we communicate with others. We have to Zoom or do some other HIPAA-compliant webcam. So, okay, if you don't have somebody in your area, you can get some expertise. You can get some consulting. I know that I do it. I help people to get to the right resources, the right meetings, the right counselors, and get them going on a program. I don't believe in just using webinars and teleseminars and phone coaching for this kind of issue. But boy, it's a great way to kickstart what you need. Okay, so that's the start. And hopefully you find a CSAT in your area, trained to know what to do to get you going, to get you the recovery that you deserve. All right, so if you try and fail, and what I know is we CSATs know the formula, so if you're not doing the formula and you need more help, maybe it's an intensive that you need. And an intensive is, it's a program. It may be 3 days, 5 days, 7 days, 10 days, 2 weeks, where you go to a center and you learn specifically the recovery tools that you need to combat this illness. Or maybe it's called Survivor's Week. You know, the Meadows has Survivor's Week, where you go and you deal with the core issues that are contributing to this problem. So, if that doesn't work, then the next step is you get residential treatment. And I got to say, that could be anywhere from 3 to 4 weeks. all the way to 6 weeks. Or I've had several clients that needed, you know, a month and a half to 2 months of therapy, and believe it or not, they needed another 6 weeks of therapy at another facility, and then they needed to go to halfway house. Okay, here's the good news and the bad news. That is a lot of time out of your life to learn how to manage this horrendous illness. But when you think about having cancer, you don't cure cancer in 6 weeks. It's typically a couple years of intensive treatment and then ongoing supportive therapy. Well, that's the same with sexual addiction. And so I know it seems daunting, but at the same time, this is your life. This isn't a dress rehearsal. You need to get diligent about it. You need to get aggressive. You need to figure out what works, and then you need to work it, because when you work it, it absolutely works. And if you don't, you're going to be fooling around, telling yourself that you're doing a good job, and ultimately you're not going to be doing the work that it really takes to get healthy. And that is what recovering addicts know, is that they absolutely have to learn how to manage this illness. And then in the 12-step program, it says when you work the program seriously and rigorously, it works. So I am so excited to be interviewing a listener who has really gone through the perils of sexual addiction. And, you know, I do believe we can all help to spread hope, strength, and recovery. So I want to welcome him to the show. And I thank you so much for offering your valuable time and resources in helping others around the world combat sexual addiction. How are you?
I'm doing great, Carol, and I'm happy to be here and to share a little bit about my story.
Absolutely. We're going to call you Joe because we're going to keep it very anonymous. That's one of the things that is important in interviewing anybody. Joe, can you tell me, how did your sex addiction begin?
Sure, Carol. Well, I feel like, you know, there were just a lot of factors that kind of came into play to kind of root in the addiction, start the addiction. And first off, you know, I grew up, I was born a very, very much an ADD child. I mean, just my parents would joke that they spanked me more than they spanked all the other four of my siblings. And so, I mean, I had no impulse control. I was going crazy, running all over the place all the time. And that connected with sexual abuse, being sexually abused when I was four by a teenage boy and some of his friends, just really lit the match under the addiction. And starting from that age, it was compulsive masturbation daily, up until my 20s, until I started to look for help or something to stop this.
And do you think it was that sexual abuse, that trauma early on, that in some ways created perhaps even a fascination and a compulsion to pursue, you know, sexuality?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I think it was. It's very clear that was the age where I was sexualized, because everything in my life, I began to just ruminate and obsess about sex. You know, along with just the compulsive masturbation at four, which is in itself pretty weird. You know, I feel like daily and multiple times daily. You know, I would you know repeat the behavior with other, you know, girls my age, and just, I mean, I know I didn't really understand that at that age of four and five, but later on, about six or seven, when that just hit me that wasn't normal, it just, the shame and the guilt just overwhelmed me as a child, and I started to show signs of depression as young as seven. And, you know, and kind of on that, and this, you know, and I know that, you know, Patrick Carnes talks a lot about his books about the different belief systems, the base lies that addicts have. And I can look back at those beliefs of I'm a bad person. You know, no one would love me if they knew who I really was. You know, sex is my most important. Those kind of core beliefs, especially, you know, being an ADD kid, I was constantly being told I was bad or I was a brat or, you know, I just was constantly getting that negative feedback from people around me. And be fair, with my behavior, I was, you know. But, you know, I don't think no one really knew what was going on below all of that behavior.
Absolutely. And you mentioned Patrick Carnes, because for people that may not know, Patrick Carnes is the guru. He is the founder of sexual addiction, and he started, well, he wrote the SAA book, Sexual Addicts Anonymous, and he started groups that were based on Alcoholics Anonymous. So he was a psychologist who also had this addiction and decided to create some self-help groups. And so you referenced him because obviously you've done some reading and you know that he says, you know, addicts either develop this compulsivity from a habit disorder or they have some sort of trauma that they're reenacting. They're reenacting in their lives until they get healthy. And that sounds like that's what you were doing.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I bring up Patrick Carnes because I know, being a longtime listener of yours, you talk a lot about CSATs and a lot of Patrick Carnes and SAA. And what excited me about that is I know that you list a lot of different programs that people can go to and resources that are out there. And I've tried a lot of those. And I think a lot of people get a lot of help from a lot of those. But after trying about everything, I finally kind of sat down and said, hey, I need to get into recovery. I need to pick one. And SAA was the one that really has helped. And actually going to a CSAT for the first time, you know, I spent about 6 months going to a CSAT here locally. And it just, I mean, talk about getting my recovery jump-started. He really, really, really helped me. And so I have a lot of admiration for what you guys do and a lot of thankfulness. And I just hope you'll keep spreading that message.
Absolutely. So then you found yourself reenacting this trauma with women. And what did that look like? How did you reenact that?
Right. So it started with, I mean, when I was at a young age, around 4 or 5, it was reenacting the behavior with girls in my neighborhood. So it was, you know, the girl next door, the girl across the street. I was having a sexual kind of relationship of molesting each other with a fourth grader, and I'm 5 and a fourth grade girl across the street. And I remember that was even the first time that I just really had this obsession with this girl. I mean, I would wait for her to come out of school. And I mean, I think there is an aspect of the addiction that's a love addiction that I have, desiring that feeling of being in love all the time. And when she rejected me eventually because of my clinginess and my controlling, you know, trying to spend so much time with her, that was a real blow. And so at around 6 was the first time I saw pornography. We were playing and we saw a magazine in a bush, and I went and looked at it, and I can still remember those images so far later. Those are just like etched in my mind, and I remember getting such a rush from looking at that magazine. I remember coming back and spending hours and hours digging through that bush trying to find it later on. So a little bit later on, I mean, it just through elementary school, it would I had the JCPenney catalog always under my bed. Masturbating to those pictures, and anytime I could look at something on TV that might be risque or later on I would steal magazines from my best friend's dad's garage and look at those, and then of course throw them away in disgust because of the shame and guilt I would feel. But then of course later on go dumpster diving looking for them again, right?
Right, absolutely.
Yeah, so it definitely progressed. It definitely progressed, and you know, I was a pretty athletic, and I was popular, and my father was a pastor, and so I was learned pretty early on how to put on kind of a mask and put on a different pretense and to hide what was really going on inside. Even though it was like there was that layer on top, but there was that really deep shame and guilt underneath. And I just felt like I couldn't tell anybody because I felt like I was such an awful person. And if anybody knew, I would be ostracized. And that's what kind of happened. And I think that's one thing that happened when I was five. I did come to my dad and I said, hey, and I told him what was happening. And, of course, he kind of wrote it off and didn't do anything about the molestation. And I talked to my mom about it, and she took, she was always a great supporter and always told me how much she loved me. So she went to the boy's mom and said, hey, this got to stop. And it didn't. So it continued on for about another 9 months. And I think, for a long time I was really angry at my dad about that, for not protecting me. But I think, now looking back now, I think that was kind of, it's almost like it was that generation of people. They just, when it came to sexual things, they didn't want to talk about it. They didn't want to talk about sex. And they just tried to move on quickly without addressing it.
Well, it's so nice to hear that you aren't blaming your father, but you understand his level of minimization, maybe denial. But your mom really took charge and she addressed the issue.
She did, and she, looking back, I mean, she could be a little bit just a little bit overbearing, I guess, like very. The mom who wanted you to be her little boy still wants you to be her little boy and live with her at home kind of thing, But she was always good about, even when people would say, you're bad, you're a brat, what's wrong with you, those kind of things. She would always say, Jonathan, it's not true. You're loved. I love you. She's always a big support in that way.
Mm-hmm.
And then later on when I was in middle school, I knew it was wrong. I knew what I was doing was harmful, and I just hated it so much. And so I remember thinking to myself, I don't care what it takes. I'm in eighth grade at this point. I don't care what it takes. I'm going to get help. And I remember thinking, I'm even willing to see a counselor. In my eighth grade mind, it was like, oh, man, you are messed up if you have to go see a counselor. I went to my dad after church one day, and I said, hey, Dad, there's something, before this, I'd started reading my Bible and going to, I really was starting to create a relationship with God. And I think he was really helping me to do this, to come out and to share this. And I said, hey, Dad, things are going really good. And I'm really enjoying reading the Bible and praying, and hey, man, Dad, there's just one thing that I just can't seem to figure out. And he goes, and before I could say anything, he said, is it masturbation, son? And I just looked at him shocked, and I went, how does he know,
mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, he had struggled with the same kinds of things for most of his life. And fortunately, he gave me bad advice. I think it would have been a great time to intervene at that point. I could have gotten some help. But he said, hey, son, I've never been able to stop, and so I don't know. I wouldn't say that it's wrong because I can't either. And later on, I kind of, there was a lot of anger toward my dad for many years, but we now have reconciled completely, and I love him to death. But, I look back at his childhood, and there was a lot of dysfunction and sexual abuse there as well. And so I see where that came from. I mean, his father was a pedophile that we found out later in life when he was in his older years, already had dementia. And there was, there was just a lot of real dysfunction there. And so I know I look back now, and I look back at how my dad led his life, and I think, wow. He did a really great job with the tools that he had. Looking at what he had to go through.
His denial with you was in part a denial of his own pain and his own trauma.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it was that same summer, you know, we got the, of course, we got the old computer with the internet. And I know you've heard plenty of sex addicts say that's like putting gas on the fire.
Absolutely.
And we both got busted that summer looking at porn on the computer. So,
wow. Okay.
Yeah, we did. And he was very, he was open. He was apologetic. We had a talk about it, all that sort of thing. So, I don't know, Carol. That's, I'm not sure where to go from that. You want me to keep going into maybe a little bit of the later years?
Well, you know, I'm sitting here thinking about how this can be, not always, but can be a generational thing. And so, obviously, your recovery and your understanding of how you have to manage this can stop any kind of generational issues that could occur. Do you have kids?
I don't, no. I just got married and we're talking about it.
Okay, so obviously you can see where your son or daughter will more than likely not have these issues because you're working on this so diligently. Probably didn't have the options that you have. Certainly CSATs weren't around, and people didn't understand this. They thought it was a moral issue. They didn't get that it was an addiction and it was compulsive and it required a whole set of tools to get through. Now, I'm just curious, what caused you to seek recovery?
Well, I think it was I knew that there was something wrong, you know, and the amount of shame and guilt that I was experiencing was overwhelming.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I had just a lot of there was later trauma in high school, and we ended up moving from our small town, and because of that and just everything that had added up, I went from a straight A student to just acting out like crazy and sleeping around like crazy. And it was so unfulfilling and I was so miserable. And I was so ashamed of it that I would share with a pastor, you know, and you know, they would, you know, try and set up some sort of accountability, but of course nothing ever worked because no one was talking about recovery. And I ended up, I would try and change my life circumstances, and I would try something new. I moved to Mexico for a while, and I joined the military. And it was after the military, in the military, my addiction really raged on and kind of, you know, went into more illicit kinds of acting out with prostitutes and that sort of thing. And I got home, and I was stealing Wi-Fi in a parking lot after I got out of the Marine Corps waiting to go to college. And I just was miserable. I was so sad. I thought, you know, I can't live like this anymore. And it's funny, you always reference the site, sexhelp.com. I just typed in the Google search bar, sex help, and that website came up. And I opened it up. Yeah, I opened it up, and I'm reading through the they ask you to take that little questionnaire, and
uh-huh.
I went through it, and it said you're a raging sex addict and you need help, pretty much. And so I just started researching churches and looking for anything that I could find that would help, and I found one locally. And I called up the gentleman. He's turned out to be one of my longtime mentors. And I called him up and I told him, I said, hey, I need, I'm looking for some help. I'm struggling with this. And the first thing he said, hey, when was the last time you masturbated? And I said, well, this morning. And he goes, great. You just broke the back of hell. I can't wait to see you. Come to group. And so I came that day. I came, or I think it was maybe that week. And in that specific group, everyone would go around when there was somebody new, and they would share a quick 2 to 3 minutes about their history, and then they'd give you the rest of the time to share your story. And so for the first time in my life, at the age of 23, I shared my entire story, things I'd never told anybody before. And I mean, I was crying and I was weeping, and you know, it was such a great feeling. And that's kind of where the the journey began for me. Now
yeah, it's that weird thing where it's humiliating, but it's relieving at the same time. It's liberating.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
So continue. Then what happened?
So I, you know, but you know what I was, in my mind I thought, you know, there's just got to be, I wanted, as an addict, I wanted that quick fix. I didn't want, you know, they were telling me that the first step in recovery was 3 to 5 years in recovery continually. And I thought, there's no way, come on. There's got to be a conference. There's got to be something I can go to. Where's the book? Where's the book that'll fix this? You know, where's the blue pill? Give me the pill. And it just, you know, and I kept messing up. I couldn't get any sobriety, you know, under my belt. And unfortunately, I moved from there. I went to college, and I got out of going to a meeting regularly. In college, I started to see my first counselor there on campus, and it wasn't a great experience. The first one fell asleep a lot while I was talking to her, so I'd have to, like, you know, wake her up.
Yep.
The second counselor I went to, you know, he had struggled with pornography at one point again, you know, another point, and he just said his advice was, you just need to make a decision to stop. And so,
okay.
Yeah, which wasn't the best advice. But so I started just trying things. I mean, I went to life groups, and I went to recovery. I went to all kinds of different church, and I would go for a little while, and then I'd get a little bit of sobriety, and then I'd act out again. And I'd lose all motivation and my shame and guilt, and I'd get right back on the addiction cycle, and I'd stop going. The only time that I had any sort of longer-term sobriety was I was going to a group based on Steve Gallagher's book, At the Altar of Sexual Idolatry. And I had about 3 months. But that also coincided with some ADD medication that I took for the first time. And so, and I know I kind of talked to you in our correspondence about how I felt, you know, mental illness and medication and things have affected my recovery. And I'm really, it really has impacted it in a major way, with depression and ADD and those sorts of things. It has helped me to get started and at least get on the road to recovery. But, so tried a lot of things. I got out of college. I got in trouble looking at pornography on the school network and those sorts of things. Had to meet with a dean for a while to work through things. It really just ended up, everyone was telling me that you have to have more discipline. You just have to be disciplined. You have to try harder. You have to pray harder. You need to read the Bible more. And I wasn't getting, I was getting that, I wanted to hear that because that sounded better than recovery for the rest of my life as an addict. I just was not willing to accept that yet. And thus I had no sobriety. So I got out of college and I got my first job and I was working from home, which is a really bad idea, by the way. Anybody who's a sex addict, don't work on your computer from home. And I was making a lot of money. And I just got so depressed. I wouldn't leave my apartment for days. I was eating fast food. I was going out and picking up prostitutes 2 to 3 times a week. From the outside, anybody looking at me would think, man, this is a successful, attractive, accomplished person. And on the inside, I was dying inside. So my one latch stitch effort to try and get cured was I went to a hyper-religious inpatient program. That was a 9-month program. And, you know, I'd have to say that there are some good things about it. Just getting unplugged, getting away from the world. You know, I started they put you in like a $9 an hour job in a giant warehouse. And you meet with a counselor and it's very much though not, they would definitely reject the 12-step principles. And they actually reject psychology altogether. So I was still trying to find something that wouldn't label me an addict for the rest of my life and I wouldn't have to go to meetings for the rest of my life. I thought, hey, I will go to this for 9 months and I will get fixed. And that didn't happen. I got out of there.
Yeah.
And I just went right back to my acting out. So, but one good thing about that place is it really humbled me. And I never realized how prideful I was and how much I hadn't wanted to surrender to the process and to God and what God might be leading me to do. And so I came back and I went from making $80,000 a year to making $28,000 a year and working a very menial kind of job. And I started fresh. And I, maybe about a year into it, I started going to SAA again. I went to Celebrate Recovery for about a year and I couldn't get any sobriety. I went to SAA for a while and it just came down to all my reading. Patrick Carnes just made the most sense to me. And I finally accepted that, hey, this is going to be a lifelong thing. And it's not something that I'm going to be able to cure overnight. This is something that I'm going to have for the rest of my life. But I don't have to live like this. I don't have to. I can get recovery. I looked at these guys. I'd go to these 12-step meetings, and I'd see these guys with years of sobriety. And I remember thinking to myself, yeah, right, that guy's got to be lying. There's just no way. And I hear their story, and I go, there's definitely no way that guy has that much recovery. But the more I went to meetings, the more I heard their stories, the more I got to know them, I mean, it was real. They really had changed. And they had changed from situations that were way worse than even my situation, looking back. And that gave me a lot of hope. Meetings gave me a ton of hope. And so I started to get short times of sobriety. But being single, again, it was so easy to act out and not have any consequences, you know. And I'd come back and I'd share that I acted out and I'd reset my sobriety time and but it was a real struggle. And I think a lot of that was because I couldn't get out of this. I'd grown up in this religious atmosphere. I'd gone to these hyper-religious, inpatient programs where they told me you were bad. And, you know, the reason why you haven't gotten recovery is because you're just not saved and you're not godly enough. And so that shame and guilt just weighed me down. And I couldn't seem to look at it objectively when I would act out. Because I would go straight into that shame and guilt, and it would just cloud over my thinking. So the first time I was able to really jumpstart my recovery is when I went to a CSAT. And he said something that was really interesting that has always stuck with me. Well, he said a bunch of things tools that I use now. But he said, Jonathan, shame and guilt is just not helpful whatsoever. You know, and he started to help me to recognize the steps, the triggers and the feelings and the steps that took that ended up in my acting out. So all I would remember is, you know, the part right before the acting out. But I wouldn't remember the hunger, the anger, the sadness or the depression or the loneliness that day. And he started to help me recognize even the physical effects of what it felt like to be triggered to putting me on that process of acting out. And he taught me how to stop that process. Learning to stop that process in the beginning rather than trying to stop it right before you're about to act out. And so to do that, when I would act out sexually, I started to analyze it more objectively. And so I pushed the shame and guilt out of my mind and I started to think, okay, this just happened. What led to this? I mean, what was I feeling? And that really started to open my eyes to what this whole process looked like. And so I started to recognize and identify the feelings that came with it. I started recognizing the different moods. I'm sure you've heard of the HART, or is it HALT? Right? Hungry, angry,
oh,
lonely,
yes.
Tired.
Hungry, angry,
stressed.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I started to recognize that. And then he goes, Jonathan, you know, you cannot, the triggering process, it can't last. It can't last more than 15 minutes. So if you'll just wait it out 15 minutes, if you'll do something to short circuit that process, call somebody, change your venue, go take a walk, do something, then it will pass. And it did. I learned that tool. It really did. It passed. So I started to get more and more sobriety, and I realized, man, I started loving going to SAA meetings. I mean, the guys were so supportive. It's like every time I hear somebody share their story for the first time, it was like hearing my story all over again. It was just amazing how similar we were. And then I met my wife. And I had been in the church that I was going to. Community was a real big part of my recovery, being a part of a loving, accepting community. And I had shared my story with them, and so she knew about my story, and I was very open with her about it. And I shared with her about the sacrifices, and I even took her once to meet with my CSAT, and he kind of explained what the addiction was, and that, you know, as being married to a sex addict, that, hey, there was going to be time commitments. He was going to need to go to meetings, and there was going to need to be this, and there was going to need to be boundaries on certain things. And, I mean, thankfully, the wonderful woman she is, she accepted that, and she loved me. And you know, she saw that the addiction, I wasn't the addiction, that I was a good person, and that was a part of me. But she saw all the other good things about me. And so I know that a lot of people say that with marriage, it's not, you know, they say with addicts that you should have a certain amount of sobriety before you get married. You know, marriage is not going to fix the problem. And I didn't have a lot of sobriety when I got married. But, you know, I feel like it's been different in my case, because having that close accountability and that relationship and that learning to develop that emotional intimacy with somebody, which I know that it was really hard for me, but knowing that and working on that has really kept me from desiring to act out sexually with pornography. And I know, I mean, I consciously know, even after being married, I know that acting out is a whole lot more exciting. It just is. Pornography, looking at pornography and acting out is much more exciting than a sexual relationship within a marriage. And people have told me that, and I was prepared for that. But what I didn't know was how fulfilling healthy sexuality within a marriage could be. I had no idea. And I'm so grateful to have a partner who's willing to work on that with me and support me and encourage me. And also, if I do mess up, I know I can tell her, and she'll be there to help me and support me. So I feel very lucky, Carol. I'm very blessed.
Yeah, it really sounds like your marriage has complemented your recovery, because she has been so open. And like you said, we always tell people, get into recovery for at least a year before you start dating, and then a couple of years before you even contemplate marriage. But you jumped that gun, and it worked out really well. Now, can I ask you, do you consider your sexual addiction a mental illness, or do you think that anything else in your background contributed to any type of mental illness?
Yeah, so, you know, that's such a tough thing, right, with some of the latest research talking about the brain neurochemistry and the plasticity of the brain and how our behavior and our thought patterns affect those neural pathways. I mean, I'm just so interested in that, because I'm not sure. I see in my family a history of ADD, and we know with ADD that there's that lack of that inability to focus, that distractibility, but also that lack of impulse control. And for the longest time, I've had that. I mean, I've been, you know, it especially comes out when talking with people. And I've really learned I've really learned that I need to discipline and think about what I say before I say it, because you just blurt things out. And so I think that connected, especially with the sexual trauma, really, I mean, I don't know what that did to my brain, but I there's a history of depression as well in my family. And again, I don't know if that's circumstances, or if there's a predilection toward that in my family. I do believe that sexual addiction is a disease. And I do think that the mental illness exacerbates that disease. And so for me, I, of course, again, like I wanted to do it all on my own. I didn't want any help. So, but I finally, I was having such a hard time just getting up and doing the daily activities because I was so depressed about three years before I got married. And I had started over after that inpatient stint. And I started taking SSRIs. And I mean, we're talking like night and day experience for me. And so those antidepressants, and I'm still on them, and I'm okay with being on them for the rest of my life, I'll be honest with you, because they have helped me so much. They have. And they really got me to a point where I was able to get up and do these things that I needed to do. You know, another thing, Carol, I wanted to tell your listeners, you know, I was diagnosed in college. It's funny, a friend of mine, I don't recommend this to anybody, but he was giving me his Adderall. And I know that's not a good thing, but I went and I found.
Tell people that may not know what Adderall is, because most do, but just in case.
Yeah, it's an ADD medication. It's a stimulant that helps somebody with ADD to focus. And it also had a big effect on me. So I went and found a master's student who was doing their thesis, psychology master's student, who said, hey, I will give you the ADD testing if you'll do the complete gamut of psychological testing for me for my thesis. And all you need to pay for is the cost of the tests. And so I took this, spent about 2 weeks, 3 to 4 hours a day, and anyways, the results of it were so interesting. She diagnosed me with PTSD. And so I think... you know, even though I wasn't getting the sexual addiction help, I did go to multiple therapists over the years, and they all worked on the trauma base. So they would help me working through those painful memories and those traumatic events that had happened. And I can't tell you how important that is to work on both the trauma, but also the behavioral part of the addiction. And I mean, Carol, there were memories that I would just even think about it and I would just start bawling. I would just start crying so hard. And going through some trauma therapy, I can look at those now today and not feel those negative emotions, but be able to objectively look at what happened and understand it.
Well, absolutely. And so I'm wondering, obviously, that trauma that you experienced is what we talk about when we say sexual trauma reenactment. And it can contribute to mental illness. It can contribute to addiction. It can contribute to wanting to medicate yourself. It can contribute to wanting to act out anger, love, and sex. Now, you obviously have a lot of insight into your own self and everything that has gone on to feed that. Do you believe that it caused any kind of depression? Do you believe it caused any kind of anxiety or obsessive compulsive thoughts?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, when you go through that addiction cycle and you act out, the depression is... Are you talking about the trauma or are you talking about the addiction itself?
I'm talking about the trauma.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, because what they do is those solidify those negative beliefs as a young child that there's something wrong with you, that I'm bad, that you know what I mean, you're different from other people, no one is ever going to love you. And so those beliefs they're solidified in that moment. In that moment when you're young, and then as you go through life, you come along situations and those lies are just right there under the surface. And for the longest time, I didn't even recognize that those lies were there. I didn't even consciously know that I was thinking these things and they were affecting my actions and my behavior. And so if you don't, I think it's very important that a person faces their pain and learns to understand and see what those lies are that are behind what's actually going on. Because what's going on isn't ever what's actually going on, right? It's always something below the surface, typically, in conflict and people are in pain. And, you know, I got to say that God has really come. I contribute it all to him. He really has come in and brought amazing healing into areas that I never thought were possible.
for our listeners who may not be sure they believe in a God, they may not be sure that they believe in a higher power, they may not have been exposed to the 12-step group or to church, you know, what? How could you share some hope, strength, and recovery for them?
Absolutely. Well, I would say the first thing to do is to, I mean, if you really want to get jump-started, is to go to a CSAT and just sit down and get the information, because they have the information that are going that's going to get you started. And I also think that there's something very powerful about being in a group of people. And so I know in my 12-step group, there are guys in there who don't believe in God, but the group itself is kind of their higher power, and it works very well for them. It works very well for them. So I don't necessarily think that you have to believe in God for there to be recovery. I know personally my relationship with God enriches my life in a very deep and powerful way. But I do know plenty of guys who are atheists or who don't believe, who are just agnostic, don't believe in God, who also have strong recovery and are just great guys, and I'm just blessed to be in a group with them. And also, you know, walk through that door for the first time. I mean, if you're in your addiction and you want, and you're just tired and sick of being tired and sick and tired, just go to a group. It's incredibly hard to go through that door the first time, but trust me, there's nobody there who doesn't know your story and understand what you're going through. And they want to welcome you, and they want to love on you, and they want to help you in the recovery process. So just reach out to somebody.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Good advice. You know, Joe, a.k.a. Jonathan, you have
shared... Yeah, sorry about that.
Yeah, I get that. You have shared two really important things. You have said, if you're really struggling, go to a CSAT. There's somebody that knows how to get to the crux of the problem quickly, and that is by going to sexhelp.com. Like Jonathan mentioned, that's where he went. He looked up just sex help, and it took him to that website that also has a test. If you're uncomfortable with that, you can go to my website, which is Sex Help with Carol, the coach, and it's the same test. The second thing you need to do is look up a specialist in your area, because they will help you with this. And then the third thing, he said go to a group, and he's really referencing 12-step meetings. Now, you talked about SAA, and we also know that SA can be helpful. Sexaholics Anonymous is a little bit different than Sex Addicts Anonymous, but both of the groups are really, really good. I loved how you said they're there to love on you. You know, they're there to make you feel welcome, not to make you feel shamed. And so for anybody out there that doesn't know how to get started, may not believe in God, they are a group of people that will accept you exactly where you are. And so, Jonathan, you obviously are into giving back, or you would not have offered to do this show. Tell us, is there one thing that you would share with our listening audience that would help convey that hope, strength, and recovery that obviously you have worked really hard to obtain and maintain?
Sure. Well, you know, it's a process, Carol. I would tell them it's a process. And, you know, there's an adage in the 12-step meetings, you know, progress, not perfection. So if you're looking for a quick fix, with this addiction, there just isn't one. And so just don't give up. Don't give up. There's nothing you can do that is ever going to be too much for you to be able to recover. Keep trying. If you fail, get back up and keep trying. Don't give up.
Well, Jonathan, thank you so much for offering to share your story. You are an elegant and articulate speaker, and I hope to have you on again. I want to hear how you're doing every year for the next 10 years. I have a feeling you're going to make a big contribution in this field, so I appreciate so much your willingness to share your story.
Thank you so much, Carol. It was great talking to you.
And you too. And keep listening to the show.
You absolutely.
All right. Take care. Right. Bye-bye. That was Jonathan. He's a listener, and he's somebody that obviously is very invested in sharing some hope, strength, and recovery, and we know that. We know that, you know, he is there to help get the message out, and I so thank you for being a part of the show, and for everybody out there, you know, there's only one of you at all times, so I fearlessly want you to have the courage to be yourself and to know that there is plenty of help out there. You just got to know where to go, and you can keep listening to this show because when you work it, it works. And I so look forward to working with you every week to help with help strength and recovery. So as I say at the end, there will only be one of you at all times. Fearlessly have the courage to be yourself. We'll see you next week.